The one thing I want to say before I discuss the Pirates of the Caribbean is that, you know, sometimes people go on about the 60s a bit too much. I tend not to do it, and it's, in my opinion, quite seriously. I mean, they were good times, and, you know, some victories were won. Not so many, but some were won. But it can be a bit demoralizing sometimes to go on about that, and I always look at the new generations, which have been radicalized by the movement against the war in Iraq, by a response to what the United States is doing. And we live in very different times. And these different times require different movements, and they are different. And each generation is different from the rest, and generations keep on changing. And I've been noticing that the new generation, all over the world, by the way, not just in one country, that it is more engaged than it was in the 80s or the 90s, and that is something to be very positive about, and that, of course, is part of the axis of hope, the new generation. Now, since 1999, 2000, I've been making a number of trips to Latin America. Why? The reason is that the victory of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela excited a great deal of interest from a small number of people in the early days. An old friend of mine, a Latin American scholar and a former Guardian foreign editor and used to be their correspondent in Latin America, Richard Gott, the minute Chavez's victory happened, rang me up and said, this is going to be something different. And do watch it very closely, because it's not any old election victory. And when I started going to Venezuela, I then discovered that this was going to be something completely different from what that country had in the past. That it was basically the first government Venezuela had, which was against the oligarchy. And that the reason this government had been elected was something which very few people knew about, which was, you know, when we talk, where did the big movements for global justice begin? People always say Seattle. Now, they say Seattle because it's in the West, it's North America, it's the United States of America, and it was very important that a movement for global justice erupted in Seattle. But 10 years prior to that, movements had already begun to erupt in Latin America. And in 1989, when you had a social democratic government in power, a pro-oligarchic social democratic government in power in Venezuela, the IMF and the World Bank were beginning to get their act together, what later became known as the Washington Consensus, and insisted that the Venezuelan government, if it was going to receive funding and aid from these institutions, needed to crack down on the poor. Of course, they don't put it in those words. Basically, they talk about reforms and modernization and all this debased language which they use, transforming the very meaning of words, because what they're doing is anti-reform. What they're doing is totally hostile to any serious modernization of the country. These are words which the elite now uses to justify neoliberal measures. And the World Bank and the IMF insisted that if the Venezuelan government was going to be given any support, then it needed to push through these measures. And the government caved in. This is 1989. The government caved in, and the poor came out onto the streets of Caracas and all the neighboring areas. And within 2 or 3 days, you had a semi-insurrection taking place in Caracas and the regions around it. And the government began to panic when this movement began to spread to the country as a whole. And this panic gripped them to such an extent that they called on the troops to come out and open fire, which they did. And what is not so well known, because the figures were manipulated and not revealed till 5 years later, was that between 2,000 and 3,000 people were shot dead, and that's a hell of a lot of people, for supposedly killing that number of people. The United States and NATO bombed Yugoslavia, charged Milosevic with war crimes, etc., etc. But for killing 2,000 to 3,000 people in cold blood and burying some of them in mass graves, the Venezuelan government showed its loyalty to the institutions of the global order and showed that it could be trusted by the new order. But that is what triggered off a whole number of things in Venezuela. And the first time I met Hugo Chavez, he said to me, "You must not underestimate the importance of what happened that day." Because he said those of us who were young officers inside the army were incredibly angry. And he called a meeting and an account of how they organized inside the Venezuelan army, you will find contained in the appendices to Pirates of the Caribbean, which consists of interviews with generals and leading figures of the left in Venezuela. And this organization of the left inside the Venezuelan army was something very crucial. But Chavez and his fellow officers said, on our own we can't do it, because that would be like having a coup d'etat. And what we have to do essentially is link up with trade unions, working class movements outside in society as a whole, and try and organize a rebellion to get rid of this government which called on soldiers to fire on their own people. So do not underestimate that, Chavez said to me, and I then went and read up a lot about this. And it was, as he said, quite an astonishing and shocking affair. Covered up, I think if someone does a Google search on the New York Times, I don't even know whether they reported it or not, or most of the Western press, because it was certainly one of those episodes which is hidden from history. That is what caused the radicalization within the army and within society, sections of sectors of the society, and I refer to this moment, tragic though it was, as the founding moment of the Bolivarian process in Venezuela. It is this that triggered it off. And unless you understand this, you cannot understand what happened to Venezuelan society. And dishonest journalists, more or less on the payroll of the Washington Consensus and its global media organizations, always try and cover this up. So what happened in 1989 was the massacres. What happened in 1992 was a rebellion led by Chavez, but the support for the rebellion which had been promised by the groups outside didn't materialize. And so it was defeated. Chavez was arrested, and audaciously enough, he said to those who arrested him, "Fine, you can lock me up. I'm not ashamed of what we tried to do. But I would like to accept responsibility for what we did publicly." And they said, "Are you sure you're going to say you're guilty?" He said, "Yeah." But he said, "I'd like to say it on national television, and then you can sentence me. There's no attempt, you know, I'm not trying to deny it." So they said, "Fine." They put him on national television. And he explained, "This is what we tried to do, to challenge what has happened in our country. I failed. It's my fault. We were not prepared. I accept my responsibility." And he said, I asked the people of Venezuela to forgive me that we haven't been successful." Now, this was the first time in Venezuelan history that anyone had gone and accepted responsibility for anything. So this in itself had a big impact. Watching events closely in Venezuela was the high command of the Latin American Revolution in Havana. And they said, "Who is this guy?" They were not prepared for it. And when I was in Cuba, they told me, they said, "You know, we were totally taken by surprise because we'd never heard of him." And so they said, "Invite him to Havana, let's see what timber he's made of." So the minute Chavez is released from prison, he's invited to Havana to give a talk. And the talk he's asked to give is on Simon Bolivar and what this means for the continent today. And Chavez arrives at Havana airport. Now, nobody, as you know, he's no longer in the army. He's just been released from prison. But he was a lecturer at the military academy, so he knows his military history very well, and he knows all of Bolivar's campaigns and how they got rid of the Spanish. In intimate detail, by the way. He can be a bit of a bore on that, but he does know it very well. So, he arrives in Havana, and to his astonishment, waiting to meet him at the airport is a familiar bearded figure. Says, hop into the car, drives him. And Fidel doesn't say very much, he lets him talk. Then he gives the lecture. Sitting in the third row is Castro and, you know, the high command. And they ask him questions and he replies. And they don't say anything to him, but they are very impressed. And they are impressed with this guy and they think he's got what it takes to move the continent forward. That's how it was described to me. And close relations are established. And then Chavez fights the presidential elections in 1999, campaigns strongly for the against the oligarchy, says what Venezuela needs is reforms, talks about the billions and billions of dollars that have been stolen by the politicians and corrupt military officers and spirited away outside the country, and says very openly, Simon Bolivar taught us, stand on your own two feet, make your own economic and political revolution, and get rid of all empires on our continent. And he says, that's what we're going to do. And the message is popular, and he wins. And it's when he begins to implement this program that the Western leaders begin to squeal in anguish. Because they thought, like many other politicians, he was saying something and when he gets elected, he'll forget about it. Because that is the way democracy functions, not in Latin America. So when Chavez began to implement his program, that is when the trouble started. They suddenly realized he's serious. And when they realized that, they made three attempts to topple him. One was by an organized coup d'etat, where they found a corrupt businessman, whose name I've genuinely forgotten now, who was their president for 24 hours. Totally corrupt businessman. They sent him to Madrid to be measured for a presidential sash. They didn't want to do that in Caracas because word would have spread. But pranced around in a Madrid outfitters being measured up for a suit and a presidential sash. And then he was brought, came back, and they organized the coup. And they thought they'd got away with it. The first day after the coup, so they organized the coup, and you know, people who organize coups imagine these coups are going to be successful because they have this confidence, we're the army, we can do what we want. What they hadn't taken into account was two things. One, the popularity of Chavez amongst the ordinary rank and file of the army. And the reasons for this popularity are twofold. One, that he's genuinely a popular political leader. Secondly, most of the army, including many officers, come from incredibly poor families. Thirdly, Venezuela is a country where the class divide is mirrored by a racial divide. So the lighter-skinned Creole oligarchs who've been running that country forever are incredibly racist. And this, I have to say, sometimes extends into the, you know, progressive intellectuals of that country who are also light-skinned. I mean, one of them told a very dear friend of mine, he said, this friend asked him, why are you so hostile to Chavez? And this guy said to him, we learned one lesson from our past, never trust a Zambo. Do you know what a Zambo is? It's of mixed slave and Indian, indigenous blood, which Chavez is. That's the name for them, Zambos. Never trust a Zambo. Well, the people did. The people did trust Chavez, which is why he was elected. So the coup d'etat, the only way it would have been successful was if they'd killed him. And if they'd killed him, they would have probably triggered off a civil war in that country. And I think they knew that. So they didn't kill him. And the messages he got smuggled in from the Cubans, Fidel said, no provocations. Do not be provocative at all. This continent has suffered enough. We do not want a second Allende. Just be very calm and let's take it slowly. And that was very sage advice, because within 24 hours, the Bolivarian circles had gone to the slums and the strongholds of the poor on the mountains, and the poor began to march down from the mountains into Caracas. And at the same time, soldiers said to their officers, if you support this coup, you do it on your own. We support our elected president. And I keep stressing this, that the legitimacy of Chavez came from the election he had won. It wasn't like the Cuban Revolution, where legitimacy derived from the revolution, but from a democratic process witnessed by all, where an elected leader was trying to implement his program. So that coup attempt failed in total ignominy for those who attempted to carry it out. New York Times had welcomed the coup as a process that could only enhance democracy. The IMF had released $1 billion on the first day of the coup as a sign of goodwill. All the European Union leaders had been told that this was taking place, so they were all prepared. So this was another Washington consensus attempt to get rid of a popular leader, and it failed. Then they organized, when that failed, the two other attempts included a referendum, calling a referendum against Chavez. You know, the irony here is that the constitution the Bolivarians gave the people of Venezuela, which they voted for, this constitution was also opposed by the oligarchy and their political parties, because they said, oh, this is demagogic. You know, what is this right to recall a president at any time if you get so many signatures? And the Chavistas and the Bolivarians said, this is a very important right, the right of a people to recall their leaders whenever they want. And they won. They won the constitution, and then the opposition tried to use that very clause to topple Chavez, and we know how they did it. They went to the banks and they told the banks to release the names of all their customers. They went wherever they had corporate strength, got names, and filled these names in. And Chavez had a choice to make. He could have said, half your votes are fake and are not going to succeed, and we will not allow these votes to be counted in the demand for a referendum because they are fake. He could have done that and they would have won, but he instead did something else. He said, okay, let's have a referendum. You want a referendum to recall me? Let's have it. And I was in Venezuela for that campaign, and it was magic. The mass mobilizations were quite astonishing. And the inevitable happened. He won by a large majority. Then they said this was rigged, but Jimmy Carter was there with his foundation, hardly a friend of that continent, but they said no. Carter actually went public and said, you know, this is the fairest election I've ever witnessed. Given that he himself has been elected President of the United States, I thought this was quite a generous thing to say on his part. And that same night when Carter agreed and said the election was fair, he was in Eastern Caracas, where the bourgeoisie lives, in a very posh restaurant. And as he walked in, he was actually jeered by the diners in that restaurant. And one or two of them spat at him. And at this point, Carter left. And as he was leaving, he told an aide, I now know the problems Chavez has if he has to deal with people like this every single day. He was genuinely taken aback and shocked by just the viciousness of this oligarchy, which has not been used to having power taken away from it. Then they organized a middle-class strike of the middle-class professions, which we know from Allende's period in Chile. All the teachers, all the doctors went on strike, and the corporations closed down the breweries, thinking that they would demoralize Chavez's supporters so much that people would be on their knees saying, come back, okay, let's get rid of him. That backfired very badly, and support for Chavez grew. And he told me at that time that this was much more serious than the coup, because he knew a coup would never succeed. He knew the army. But he said here they were actually playing with people's lives, closing down hospitals, closing down schools, that I was really worried that it might work. But he said, I went into the poor areas of Caracas to talk to people. And he said, I got so much strength from there. And he described to me something which happened, which I think I put on the back of this book because it's so moving. He said a poor woman came up to him and said, hey, Chavez, come with me. And he went into her tiny little apartment. And she said, this is my family, we are making the evening meal. And a whole family was sitting around a low table in the kitchen, and soup was being cooked on a fireplace. And by the way, the strikes were affecting electricity, everything. And she said, can you see what we are burning to make the soup? And Chavez said, no. She said, it's a chunk of our bed. Tomorrow we'll burn the whole bed. The day after we'll start burning the doors in our house. The day after we'll go and forage for wood. But we don't want you to give up. Because if you give up now, we're all finished. And then the oligarchic press had said that if the unemployed youth in gangs didn't get their beer, they would riot and bring the government down. And Chavez said, as he was walking out, these kids walked up to him and said, Chavez, screw the beer, don't you give up. Just don't give up. Now, you know, this was two or three tiny events, but they reflected the anger of the people and the rising level of political consciousness at the same time, that they had a government which was doing some modest, limited things for them which no one had done before. So all the attempts to topple him failed, and so all they are left with is their bile and the vicious propaganda which is waged against him endlessly in the transatlantic media in particular, because they can't stand any challenge to the new order. And what Chavez does, in a true Bolivarian way, is he challenges the right of the United States to determine what happens to the world, and he is using the oil money to slowly transform the living conditions of the poor in Venezuela by doing elementary things. Free schools, free universities, free clinics. The one thing I forgot to tell you is that when the doctors closed down their hospitals and the schools were closed down, a lot of community organization of schools began to take place. Volunteers came and set up community schools to educate the poor kids. And Chavez said one day he rang Fidel and said, you know, we're having real problems. And the Cubans, within 2 weeks, had sent 14,500 doctors into Venezuela with free medicines. Cuban medicines, setting up clinics in the poorer sections of the country. And the oligarchy really shot themselves in the foot when they said, these are not really doctors, they're Cuban terrorists who are coming to start a FOCO and guerrilla wars all over our country. This really backfired, because the whole country, including some people who voted for these oligarchic parties, got free treatment. And then from poor families, people with real bad eye trouble were just flown. There was a more or less continuous flow of people to Havana to get our free eye operations and coming back. Now, you know, in a poor country, in bad neoliberal times, this is just incredible. Because even traditional social democratic reforms have been outlawed by the new order. Which is why, if you compare and contrast what is happening to democracy in the capitalist heartlands, North America, Western Europe, you no longer have any serious choice. Center-left or center-right, they do the same things. The culture of the center-left is different from the culture of the right, so on one or two things they are slightly better. But not in any meaningful sense, because money dominates politics, and the links between money and power now are so close, whether it's on a local level, a regional level, a national level, in virtually every European country, that there is a growing alienation of young people from the democratic process. Not true in Latin America. Here, democracy is being enhanced, but by the social movements from below. And then the victories in Venezuela, and I think in the election, which takes place in a few weeks' time, Chavez will win again. That's what all the opinion polls are showing him, 30 points ahead of his rival. But the Bolivian movement, like the Venezuelan one, also grew out of the big social movements in Bolivia. And these were social movements which challenged the right of corporations to privatize basic necessities of life. The water privatization campaign. Bechtel bought the water supplies in Bolivia. And there was an insurrection in Cochabamba. But a genuine insurrection. The entire town rose up against it. They opened fire. Mercifully, very few people, more people were injured than killed. One guy, I think one or two people died. But that was enough to light the flame. And they won that right. They defeated Bechtel, the government caved in, and the Bolivian, the Cochabamba municipality in Bolivia won the right to have the water again. So that victory then made people, including the most underprivileged sectors of Bolivian society, the indigenous people, gave them the strength to think that they could win. And the Movement for Socialism, which is the party of Evo Morales, won as a result of the big social movements and upheavals that had taken place in Bolivia. So you now had another pirate, not from the Caribbean, but ready to join the pirate ship of the Venezuelans and the Cubans. And Evo Morales was very upfront in his campaign. At one press conference 2 weeks before the election, they said, "What about relations with the United States?" And Evo said, "I will become a nightmare for the United States." And you know, it requires courage to say that in this world, by the way. How many Western politicians would even come close to saying that? Even those on the left don't talk like that. Because the power and domination of the United States is so strong. So the victory of Morales was yet another leap forward. And then we were waiting to see what would happen in Mexico. Not because Obrador was exactly like these guys, but nonetheless, in foreign policy terms, it would have been a defeat for the United States if AMLO had won, if Obrador had won, and everyone knew that. And the victory was expected. And this victory was snatched from Obrador by total and complete state manipulation of the votes, large-scale corruption, and a refusal of the Mexican state to permit any international observers at this election. Carter was not allowed to go to Mexico. Just imagine if Chavez had done that. Just imagine if the Venezuelans said no outside observers. The entire media would have said, well, we know why. No one says that about Mexico, though everybody knows who knows that country well, that the elections were totally and completely rigged. They were not prepared to tolerate an Obrador government in Mexico City and in Mexico, because they felt this would then really complete the tilt of the continent in that direction. Now, of course, the largest country in Latin America is Brazil, and here we had the last of the great working class parties of the 20th century, and the most recent working class party of the 20th century, the PT, elected to power by the poor, and they had a choice. They say they didn't have a choice. They had a choice. They were elected because the large-scale deindustrialization of Brazil, the destruction of the national bourgeoisie, bringing in finance capital in a big way into the country, of course, made the elite and a large layer of the upper middle class is very wealthy, but the disparities, the social disparities, became enormous, which is why people, the poor, voted for Lula. And I remember I was in Brazil in that first election campaign of Lula in one of his strongholds, and I was speaking on literature. You know, I'd been invited to a big literary festival. And of course, I had to, you know, fulfill that commitment. But people in the question period began to say to me, if you were a Brazilian, who would you vote for? And I said, if I were a Brazilian, I would vote for Lula. And there were mega cheers. And I said, but hang on, I would vote for him. And I said, you will vote for him, and the majority of Brazil's poor will vote for him. But will he listen to you and do what you want, or will he listen to those who have not elected him but who will dominate him, i.e. the IMF, the World Bank? And there was a frisson as to how could I possibly say that. And I explained to them that Lula's advisors were advising precisely that. They wanted him to become a tropical Blair. And he did. And he did, which is why he was punished in the first round in the recent elections. And the left candidate to the left of him got 6 million votes. But obviously, in the second round, they left united to make sure that the right was defeated, and Lula's been re-elected. And he was campaigning for Chavez 2 weeks ago in Venezuela. And attacking now for the first time he was critical of the elite that runs Brazil. I have very little illusions on that score, but we shall see. But the point I want to make is that it's very rare for an entire continent to shift to the left so rapidly. That has never happened in any other continent before. Neither in Europe nor in Asia. But it is happening in Latin America, and there's nothing mystical about it. This is the continent in which they experimented their socially conservative neoliberal policies from the time of Pinochet's victory in Chile from 1973 onwards. Chile was the first laboratory, and then it moved. Argentina became another laboratory. Then the entire continent was taken by neoliberalism, and that is where the resistance came first. And I often say to Western trade unionists who caved in before the big privatizations in Europe in particular, and in North America to a certain extent, I say to them, you think you are very advanced working class organizations, and you used to be, but you have a great deal to learn from the peasants of Peru and the workers of Cochabamba. You have a great deal to learn from them, because they, with the most minimal organization, defeated their enemies and are propelling governments to power which are trying to do something. So this is the situation that we now have in Latin America, and I call it an axis of hope for the following reason. That while there is resistance in Iraq to the American occupation, as I remember, I spoke in Vancouver soon after the war and predicted or said that there will be a gigantic resistance developing, and that has happened. And now it's developed in Afghanistan as well. And the Israelis suffered a heavy psychological and a tiny military blow when they tried to take Lebanon and make it into an Israeli-American protectorate. We know all that. These are good things, in a sense, to show the imperial power you can't always have it your way. The problem with these resistance movements is that they have virtually no social vision for their own people, And because they have no social vision for their own people, which is superior to that of the imperial social vision, they cannot make an impact in the United States either. And many of them will, if they are given power, will become neoliberals. I have very little doubt about that. And then, of course, new contradictions will arise. Latin America is the only continent today in which several countries are producing political leaderships from below, which are being propelled upwards from below, who have a social vision. And this social vision is to use the wealth of the continent to aid the poor and to help the poor, which seems very moderate, and in a way it is, but in a neoliberal world it's ultra-radical. That's what you have to understand. And that is why when Chavez offers poor people in the United States cheap oil, especially in the Hispanic and Afro-American communities, even, you know, congressmen who would hate his guts can't refuse it, because it's a popular offer. But the reason why that's important is because that appeals directly to the people in the United States over the head of their politicians. And now people said to me, but don't you think when Chavez spoke at the General Assembly, he was wrong to call Bush a devil? I said, well, this is a sort of tiny tactical thing. You know, he may be right or he may be wrong, but what interests me more than what he called Bush, and I said Bush has called him all sorts of names as well, including that, which is why he was returning the compliment. But I said that what is more interesting and more important than what he said about Bush is that he used the United Nations General Assembly to appeal to the American people and advise them to read Noam Chomsky. Now, I said, even more interesting is that large numbers of Americans who'd heard his speech followed his advice. And that within 24 hours, Noam's book had become top of the Amazon.com bestseller list, and within a week it was number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. So I said, this is called educating America. And it's interesting that a Latin American leader hostile to the American empire has to come and do it. And what is even more interesting is the impact that it has. And this point I'm making about constantly working politically in such a way as to have an impact on the population of the United States is very important for us, because that is the population, however difficult it may seem, which has to be spoken to and won over. And one big change that has happened in the United States over the last 50 years is now you have, which makes Latin America even more important, is you have a gigantic Hispanic population in the United States, Spanish Americans, and they will play more and more of a role. And so the link between South America and the United States of America, you have an automatic bridge there. And how this plays out will depend a lot on what happens in Latin America, and to a certain extent on what happens in the United States. Which is why my old sparring partner Sam Huntington has now dropped all his talk of clash of civilizations, which he used to go on about, and he says we have a bigger problem than Islam. And the problem we have is the Hispanic population of the United States of America. A, they are Hispanic, they come from South America. B, they are Catholics. Interesting how the civilizational clashes develop. And he says they challenge the hegemony of the traditional layers of the US ruling class for the rest of this century. Well, that's very interesting. Well, how are you going to keep this hegemony? In any case, these are interesting discussions and debates which are taking place. And we shall see how they sort out, but it is from that point of view the beginnings, if you say, hope is being reborn in South America. And I want to end my talk by reading to you a tiny extract from a Spanish nobleman of the 18th century who advised the Spanish king when Simon Bolivar was a young lad of 18, visiting Madrid. He wasn't aware that this advice had been given to the Spanish king, but whether he was aware of it or not, he more or less carried it out in the years which followed. This was in 1783, soon after the US Declaration of Independence. The Spanish nobleman was the Count of Aranda, dispatched the following memorandum to his monarch, advocating home rule, basically, for the colonies. And this is what he said: "Great possessions cannot be held forever. The present situation is rendered more difficult by the enormous distances which hampers the dispatch of help, by the slowness of the authorities and the selfishness of the government." Of course, you all know that Spain controlled the entire continent barring Brazil. "That pygmy republic, the United States, which today needs France and Spain to exist at all, will one day grow into a colossus, will forget all the benefits it has received at the hands of both powers, and will dream only of might. The freedom of conscience, the growth of a huge population in that vast territory, the advantages of the new government will draw workmen and peasants from all countries, for men pursue success, and the time will come when we shall painfully feel the tyranny of the giant. It will then attempt to get Florida and the Gulf of Mexico into its power, will hamper our trade with New Spain and endeavor to conquer it, since the two countries are strong and adjacent, while we shall hardly be able to defend it. These apprehensions, sire, are only too well founded, unless their realization is forestalled by other yet graver changes in our parts of America. Everything will combine to urge our subjects to fight for their independence at the earliest opportunity. We should therefore give up all our possessions, retaining only Cuba and Puerto Rico in the north and a small part of the south to provide us with ports for our trade. Trade should be built up on terms of perfect equality with these countries. The four nations, Mexico, Peru, and the Costa Firma, must feel themselves bound by an alliance, offensive or defensive, for their common welfare. Since our industry is unable to provide South America with all necessities, France must send them. England, on the other hand, must be rigorously excluded." Charles III, the King of Spain, said that Count Aranda was an inveterate pessimist. Every single thing he said came to pass. And the irony is that Bolivar was in town when this guy was around, but had no idea that these things were being said. So there are ironies in history. Now, one last thing is just an explanation for the cover of this book. Is that when we'd done the cover of The Three Pirates, news came through that Fidel was very ill, and the publishers were so panicked and said, "Oh, can we still have him on the cover if he dies?" So I said, "Well, I think we can, but just to be on the safe side, put a halo around his head." And I told the Cuban ambassador this, who I hope has passed it on, that, you know, we will not forget. But anyway, thank you.